Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored? Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
Welcome to the Good Food Podcast. I'm Tom Kerridge, and in this episode, I sat down with Paul A. Young to talk about how to use up your leftover chocolate, perfect for the upcoming Easter weekend. Paul also reveals his top secret salted caramel sauce.
Right, here's my sea salted caramel recipe, everybody.
Okay, we're ready.
Get your pens ready.
Plus, find out his cookery confessions. Today, I am joined by amazing chocolatier, Paul A. Young. Hello, Paul. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm very, very well. Where have you travelled from today?
Well, London, but via Staithes in North Yorkshire, right by the sea.
Wow.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
Even in the wintertime?
Oh, it's been a brutal winter.
Your history is amazing. You worked with some of the most incredible and amazing chefs and then set up on your own.
Yeah. I had this amazing job offer in 96 from Roger Pisey, who's now the executive pastry chef at Fortnum's. And it was to be a pastry chef. I wanted to be a pastry chef, and I couldn't get a job as a pastry chef in 96 in Leeds, where I was living.
Right.
And, of course, I said yes. It was at the Criterion.
And the Criterion was owned at that point by Marco Pierre White.
Yeah. He hadn't had it that long. We were turning three times the night tables.
Yeah.
Service 5:30 till 11:30. And Roger taught me every skill of being a phenomenal pastry chef to the point where, you know, you have to perfect, don't you, to be a pastry chef.
Yeah.
I remember making puff pastry 5 days solid, morning till night, to get it right.
It's one of those, it's the big difference, I think, and many people don't kind of see it when you say you're a chef or a pastry chef. People assume you're just the same, but you've just got a skill set with flour and sugar, but it's not. It's a very different mindset in a kitchen, isn't it? Because hot chefs, and from that hot side of the kitchen mirror, is something I consider myself one of those guys. You play with instinctiveness and think, you know, a structure of meat and the way that vegetables are and water contents and seasonality. It's always evolving and changing. Pastry section, you have to work in a much more of a controlled way, don't you? And measurement, I mean, it's precision driven, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I was always attracted to pastry and sweet things, but the precision, you have to have that brain to do it. And if you don't, you can't. I trained as an all-round chef. Classic French training.
Yes.
Reduced sauces and a ton of butter.
Yeah.
I still do a ton of butter, but it's in sweet things. I enjoy that precision, but there's very little wiggle room.
Yeah.
You have to be very fine and detailed. But what I loved about it was, with Marco Pierre White, we didn't just do sweet pastry. He kept the savoury pastry element with the pastry chef. So if there was something pasta-related on the menu, I made the pasta. If there was a savoury pastry dish on the menu, I would make it. So it was lovely to do that. But I can't get my head around what you do and being able to go, throw it. I know this is not
playing. No.
When you throw in, you can be a bit more cavalier with it. And I mean that in the sense of a bit more herb, a bit more salt, a bit more pepper. You do that with pastry and it ruins it.
Yeah, things go out of the window, don't they? One of the biggest things for, you know, when we opened and worked through the Hand and Flowers, which, you know, is my first space, and we didn't employ or have a pastry chef. We were all just
really
kind of kitchen chefs that when we wanted to try and perfect, and even when we got to that two-star level, I would work out what we'd want on the menu. And because we weren't pastry chefs, we'd have to work really hard at that pastry thing. We'd have to remove ourselves from that process of being in that hot kitchen and look at how do you make the best souffle? How do we do it? What is the understanding of it? And we would hone our skill of going, right, we make really good souffles. Now we can do it like this. But then if we changed the recipe, like we went from rhubarb to apple or strawberry or banana, everything would suddenly collapse again. A brand new recipe. And it's not like that in a hot kitchen, because you go, right, I'm basting and cooking a loin of pork, or I'm doing the same thing with a piece of beef, or I'm doing it with a rack of lamb.
Yeah.
It's all about touch and feel, and you can move it from one to another, even though the ingredients are different. Pastry, it's so different, isn't it?
It's completely different. It's an element of, I'm putting the souffle in the oven, will it rise? You've followed your recipe, you've followed your technique, you've been doing it for, will it rise?
Yeah.
Will the fondant come up? Will my lemon tart at the time wobble and set without a crack in it? All these little things. But we were taught very well. And I worked through a few restaurants. So I was very lucky. So I then moved to Titanic.
Yeah.
Which you opened, which was a mega,
mega machine of a restaurant.
150 covers for dinner on busy nights, which was about 300 desserts, sticky toffee pudding, lemon tart, sherry trifle, but very refined versions of a beautiful Marquise de Chocolat, very layered up, very complicated.
Yeah.
But then we would make all of the English muffins for the Eggs Benedict, all of the pastry, all of the pasta, and it was a machine. It was a well-oiled machine. You know what it's like. If you have the right team in place, it's a dream. You don't even need to speak.
No,
you
things know happen.
You know who's doing which dessert, which fridge. It just slickly happens. When it falls apart, it's a nightmare.
But yeah, for 750 people. The Titanic, not just by name.
It didn't sink, thankfully. Then I was very lucky. Marco asked me to be the head pastry chef at Quo Vadis. For reopening, so he reopened, closed it, then reopened it, built his first
beautiful restaurant, and gorgeous. One of the most, I suppose, iconic and recognised British restaurants with such wonderful history.
Well, that's when I was nervous. He moved me over to the Oak Room to get some extra experience. That was a phenomenal pastry kitchen. That was another
next
world.
Next level, another world.
You know what it's like.
Yeah.
My stomach was in knots that morning. Even though I was confident and professional and I knew what I could do, going into a kitchen where the pastry chefs had been there for a long time, and that room, the Oak Room, was amazing. Then I got moved back to Quo Vadis when it reopened, and that's when I was allowed to create some of desserts of my own.
Wow. Okay, that's a huge responsibility. And but that's a testament to your skill set. And that's amazing for Marco to said, right, you go ahead. You make me something. Show me what you can do.
Well, isn't that wonderful that a chef of his caliber could say, okay, guys, you come up with the du jour menu, the daily menu for this week. You know, three starters, three mains, three desserts. You have to present them to him and he has to agree them and we'll tweak them. And I remember, I remember the excitement of the first day of opening, the reopening. We'd practiced and practiced. We were all nervous. We were all new to each other in the kitchen, a brand new brigade. And the first person through the door, J-Lo.
Oh, no
I
way!
Know. And at the time, I didn't know who Jennifer Lopez was. I think she just had a single out. I knew she was an actress, but I didn't really know her. And then this boom happened. Chefs were coming in, writers, food critics, and well-known people. We knew we were doing a good job. Sustaining it at that level for those hours and those amount of days, non-stop, that was the challenge. But that training of fresh is best and getting every plate bang on is what led years later to me becoming a chocolatier. Because you're not making 10 chocolates, you're making 500, 1,000, 10,000, little tiny things that all have to be the same quality and fresh.
So what happened then? How did that move then come from Quo Vadis and being a great pastry chef working for the amazing Marco Pierre White to going, do you know what? I'm going to do it for myself and chocolate is my world.
I had 3 years between pastry chef and really focusing on chocolate. And I did a year developing ready meals.
Yeah.
Now, I wanted some experience in product development. How do I get an idea in my head, not just onto a restaurant plate, but to consumers? And that was Japanese, Chinese, and American ready meals. And I was in Sheffield at the time where the factory was developing them. I then got an offer from Sainsbury's place was called Cater's Kitchen for their pizzas. Every pizza was handmade apart from one. Wow. At that time. Wow. We had 1,000 employees making. But again, that was a product manager's role.
Yeah.
So I had a bit more responsibility, and I wanted to learn about packaging, about technical, about shelf life.
So these are all really important parts, the understanding. Yeah. It's not actually making the pizzas or making ready meals here.
No.
You're learning so much more about the job and the process and the understanding of the much bigger picture.
Yeah. Then I got a phone call from one of the ex-chefs I've worked with at Quo Vadis, and he'd got together quite a chunk of the old team from Quo Vadis to open and head up a restaurant in Mayfair called La Rascasse at Café Grand Prix. And I ran the pastry kitchen for 18 months there. All my own desserts.
Yeah.
All my own innovation. Amazing. Incredible. However, I just got to a point where chocolate had started to winkle its way in, and I don't really know why. The only thing I could put it down to at the time was I couldn't buy the chocolates I wanted to eat. I was done with having strawberry creams, fudges, hard caramels, and flavours that were not seasonal, and none of them had the ingredient in. So if you bought a strawberry chocolate, it had never seen a strawberry.
So it was flavour profiling. Yeah. It was things that were just being put together with it. Because that's the one thing that I think we talk and we look at from, I think, kitchen chefs, that you do follow seasonality.
Yeah.
Whereas, and then pastry quite often just follows beauty and sweetness.
Yeah.
And then go, how do we go? But yeah, you were then going, hold on a minute. Mm. I've spent all this time with the great Marco. Yeah. I've gone through product development. I should be creating chocolates that are about the produce.
Yeah.
This is where I want to go. This is what I want to do. Yeah. So what was that next step then? How did it happen?
Well, I wrote a letter, a physical letter on paper to the producers at Great Food Live, which I think was called Good Food Live. Jenny Barnett was the host, and it was a daily live chef show. Because I saw a chef cook a rhubarb crumble, and the rhubarb crumble had sunk completely and there was no crumble left. And I got a little bit annoyed. I went, come on, people need more than this.
Yeah.
So I just wrote in, said, I think I could show you something different, particularly with chocolate. And they gave me a meeting and a screen test.
Wow.
And I got on the show, this
That's
live show.
That's amazing.
And the first recipe was a chocolate tortellini recipe.
Right.
Live on the show.
Yeah.
Really complicated. With a blood orange sauce, a lovely shredded basil, you know, really complicated. I then got offers for doing food festivals, demonstrations. And the one thing I always picked up as a pastry chef was chocolate. I'm making a chocolate dessert.
Because everybody loves chocolate, don't we? We
Whatever
all
you do.
Love chocolate. Yeah. We all love cooking and making things with chocolate.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored? Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
Your experience then of showcasing to the wider public, what would you say then, what's the easiest tips that you've got for cooking and making chocolate? What would you say is something that everybody should look out for?
Chocolate is still intimidating to a lot of people. And it's, what should I buy? What I want everyone to know is that cooking chocolate and chocolate you eat should be the same thing. So if you see something that is sometimes called compound chocolate or chocolate flavoured coating, it's in the supermarkets, that isn't chocolate. And don't call it cooking chocolate. I wouldn't use it. It isn't chocolate. So the chocolate you cook, bake with should be the chocolate you enjoy to eat.
What is the difference between the two then? What is the chocolate that isn't chocolate?
There are three varieties. Well, there are two. One is completely had never seen a cocoa bean in its life. It is a hydrogenated palm oil or vegetable fat, flavourings, sugars, sometimes a tiny bit of cocoa, but no chocolate. Then you've got confectionery, which is all the mainstream chocolate, which has additional fat other than cocoa butter. So it will have mango kernel oil, vegetable oil, palm oil, all these shea butter. And then real chocolate, the only fat, whether it's milk, white or dark, should just be cocoa butter.
Right. Okay. And that's what you want to cook with.
Yeah.
That's the butter, the butter solids that come through that are different between white chocolate, milk chocolate, dark chocolate, they're the things that separate it from its bitterness and its sweetness.
Exactly. And its complexity. And if you're making a chocolate, something simple, like a little pot au chocolat or a fondue, you melt your chocolate, you want to dip things in, you want the nicest tasting chocolate you can get. However, we can get into this, but I would never buy an expensive Kraft bean-to-bar, single origin bar, to then put through the oven.
Right.
And bake it. It will destroy the complex flavours of it.
Okay, so there's a level that you can go to. Like, yeah. it's like cooking with the finest wines, like yeah. putting it in a beef stew. There isn't that much point. You may as well drink that yeah. with the beef stew, but still use a good wine with the stew. And you do the same with chocolate.
Exactly. But this was how I got into chocolate, you see. So I was looking at chocolate going, I can't buy the chocolates I want. They were all Belgian style or Swiss style. So I just started playing at home.
So Belgian and Swiss style, you mean that there's a lot of added fat.
Lots of
to
pralines,
it.
Butter whipped in. Quite often just one milk, one dark, one white chocolate used across all of the flavours.
Yeah.
And lots of pralines. I love a praline. I love a hazelnut and almond praline. But where could I find seasonal chocolates with seasonal flavours that you could say were British? We know the chocolate can't come from the UK itself. It's 10 degrees around the equator.
Yeah. But yeah, everything chocolate doesn't grow here.
But everything else can.
Unless it's the Eden Centre. Yeah. I've seen it there.
There's a tree. And I thought, well, I was going to play. And I started playing. And I got a phone call from Chantal Cody, who was the founder and owner of Rococo Chocolates on the King's Road. And she said, would you make a cake for my shop window for the first National Chocolate Week? And I said, yeah, okay, because I was making cakes as well at the time.
Yeah.
And then she said, rang back and said, I've heard you're making chocolates. Would you make some fresh chocolates? So this was a first. No preservatives, handmade, short shelf life. So not 6 months or 6 weeks, a couple of weeks. And I made a ported pear truffle. We had to use port.
Yeah.
And I made a port marzipan and they sold out.
Wow.
She then said, you should definitely enter these chocolates into the first Academy of Chocolate Awards. And I was like, no. I don't have a website. I don't know how to work a computer. I make them from my kitchen at home. There's no way I could do it. No. I met Kate, put them down. She said, oh, you should enter these into the Academy Awards. And it was a sea salted caramel, a raspberry ganache. Entered them. And I did. And my salted caramel was the first sea salted caramel to win a gold award. And that started my business.
Wow. How long ago was that?
That was 2005.
Right, okay.
A long time ago.
Yeah. So, and then since then, you set up the business, you had a shop.
Yeah, we grew to four shops at one point. Yeah.
And then since then, you've gone, right, okay, I'm done with that. I'm regrouping.
We had 18 wonderful roller coaster, you know, it's like years.
Yeah.
We went up to four shops, a production kitchen in each store.
Right.
Which
okay.
is a nightmare to manage logistically. However, at the time it was a great USP. When I went to Paris and I went a lot for my patisserie side, I used to look at the chocolate shops and through the back or downstairs or upstairs, they were making them on site. And I thought, well, why can't we do that in the UK?
Yeah.
Why do we have to have a factory?
Yeah.
That's how that ethos of making on site daily started. And yes, so we built up, we got to about 38 members of staff, and it was amazing to train people from scratch who'd been chefs who'd moved into chocolate and pastry chefs who'd moved into chocolate and people who'd never touched chocolate. And it was phenomenal. I had so many great experiences. It was one of those adventures which I'll never ever forget.
No, being in business and being in business with food is amazing.
Yeah.
And we've got, listen, it's Easter coming up. So,
oh, yeah.
You know,
huge.
It's huge. And the chocolate world goes into, well, meltdown, doesn't it? Like, there's so much goes on right now. But then what happens? What should people be doing with uneaten Easter eggs? Because, you know, if you've got kids or you've got, you know, family and people are buying loads of stuff, there's lots of chocolate Easter eggs are floating around. What would you say is a really good thing to do with leftover?
Well, every interview I've ever done about leftover eggs, everyone goes, oh, there's never any eggs left over. Oh, there is.
Yeah.
There's always something.
Yeah.
And the way you can look at it is, you've either been bought an Easter egg you don't like. So if you're a milk chocolate lover and you've been bought a dark chocolate egg, you're probably going to leave that
till last. Yeah.
Or you've just been bought too much sweet. And quite often, it's going to be the mainstream Easter eggs, milk chocolate. And there are some trends that are out there at the minute. This is interesting. If your Easter egg, when you open your box, falls apart in two halves, it's been made in two halves and yeah. might have something inside. So very easy to have two halves. Most Easter eggs are made on spinning machines where it's a sealed egg. So it's quite hard to get it to break in two.
Yeah.
You have to get a knife and kind of go around the edge, the sealed edge. So the biggest trend at the minute is to use that half egg as a bowl, an edible bowl.
Right.
And if you think of all the cold desserts, you can pile into it. And they are piled in. So I love cheesecake. So yeah. you take the half egg, put your biscuity base in the bottom, your chilled cheesecake mix on top. So your cream cheese, icing sugar, vanilla.
Whichever flavour you're going to put
it with. Whichever flavour, yeah. and some double cream. And then put your topping on. That's your bowl.
What a lovely idea. It's great. I love that. Cheesecake in an Easter egg. Yeah. What more could you want? I mean, that sounds
it's
mega.
Great. yeah. The other one is a bit dirtier,
yeah.
which I do love a dirty version of anything,
yeah.
which is you get your half egg and you go, right, it's Nutella, it's cookie dough, it's all those really naughty things.
Right, okay.
But it's Easter. Why
yeah.
not?
Yeah. I love that as well.
But using that chocolate to make anything with is hard because it's very high fat, high sugar.
Yeah.
However, your dark egg, way more versatile.
Right.
You can do the same thing with it. However, if you just smash it up into tiny pieces, it makes the best hot chocolate.
Right.
Because you smash it up into little pieces. Use it as chocolate chips.
Now, the milk chocolate is harder to do those yeah. sort of things with because of the fat content in it. It's super sweet.
It gets yeah. fatty, it can split.
Yeah.
And it gets too sweet. With your dark chocolate, you can then control the sweetness. So if you smash it up, melt it into a mug of hot milk.
Yeah.
If you want to be super indulgent, half cream, half milk.
Nice.
Ooh. And then your dark chocolate, whisk it up. You can control the sweetness with a little bit of sugar or honey or maple syrup. Or, like I say, smash it up, use it in as chocolate chips in cookies. Or one thing I love to do, I love chocolate when it's not crisp. You know how everyone goes, oh, I love the crisp crack of chocolate.
Yeah.
I love it melted.
Yeah.
There's nothing better. It's the sexiest, most provocative thing.
Melted chocolate.
Oh. So just melt it in a bowl, get your berries, get your brownie cubes, get your cookies, get your fruits, and just dip and eat it that way. Because you get the instant complexity of the dark chocolate.
Now, the different flavour profiles oh, yeah. that start coming through, whether it's fruitiness or bitter notes or whether...
Sour, yeah,
exactly.
Tangy, yeah.
All those sort of flavours that come through once chocolate has melted. What about growing up then as a kid? Yeah. Was food always really important to you growing up and the family? Who taught you to cook? Where did that interest come from?
I think I have maybe one of the last few experiences of really considered home cooking. I lived in a tiny mining village on a council estate. We're a single parent family. My great granddad lived a 2-minute walk around the corner, and his daughter, my grandma, lived half a mile away, which we walked to. And my great granddad had a coal range fired oven still in his kitchen. And I think I had the remnants of rationing. It was the 70s. So I was born in 73. So right up into the early 80s. On a Monday night, my grandma would go to my great-granddad's and in his coal-fired oven would make a beef stew with these big Yorkshire puddings, but with beef dripping, not vegetable oil. Oh, God. I can still remember it. And we'd sit and have tea at, after school, 4:30,
yeah.
in his kitchen. Then on a Tuesday night, we'd go to my grandma's friend and she'd make a corned beef and potato and leek pie, like layered, sliced, and we'd have tea there. My granddad would grow potatoes, broad beans, and I remember podding them and him pulling up the potatoes. Sundays were all the family at my grandma's for Sunday roast. And then this is where my life changed. Immediately after eating, so about 1 o'clock, my grandma would turn into stealth baker woman.
Really?
She was amazing. So she would bake a corned beef pie, an apple pie, scones, cakes, biscuits, you name it, for more family to arrive for Sunday tea. Now, I naturally gravitated towards my mum in the kitchen, and she taught me how to make fudge and toffee when I was tiny, because I learned how to... I could bake a cake at 8 years old,
That's amazing.
My grandma would... But my grandma was the head chef. She saved up and bought herself an Aga. And so she was firewoman.
Yeah.
So the only... It was either... I would walk, go in, and she'd say... Either the wind was in the right direction or the wrong direction. The Aga was fiercely hot and would burn everything or it wouldn't bake. But she was pastry. She made the pastry, rolled it out and managed the oven. I would make the cakes and she'd put them in and move them round and put the tray in the top and take it out so they didn't get burnt. She didn't know at the time, and I didn't, that what she was doing was like head baker material.
Yeah, absolutely. The technique, understanding, moving things around.
You can't turn it up and down. No. It was hot or not.
No, an auger is either it's on, and those are the temperatures. Yeah. You know, of each drawer each particular oven side of it.
And it was a coal-fired one. It wasn't a gas or electric.
So that's such an interesting, like, because there's so many people, like my journey into food was definitely not like that. Mine was through very similar single parent family, but it was cooking crispy pancakes or having a pot noodle. Yeah. But there was no auger, there was none of that.
Yeah.
But I could see then how that love of baking and particularly that pastry side suddenly became
part
of your life. And there's such a romantic kind of sense as you talked about it then, you could see that your face came alive as you were talking about those wonderful memories. Food is the most magical, has the most magical sense for that. What about dishes then? Your favourite, what's your favourite dish? You're going to talk me through, I've got no understanding of food. What's your favourite dish? Talk me through the flavour profiles and the techniques and the structure of it and how you do it.
Can I have a sweet and a savoury?
Yeah.
One's really quick, go on one's then. A bit longer.
Yeah.
It's like suet pudding.
Right. Yeah, but sweet or savoury?
Savoury.
Okay.
I don't mix. My grandma made this. It's not what you might think. It's not suet. It's not a suet pudding with steak inside. This is, she took plain flour, a generous amount of beef suet, lots of salt, mixed it with water, and then put it in a tin. So like it could have been a foil tin from a pie she'd had, not necessarily something permanent, and it would go in the oven and bake. And it would be super crispy on the top. Like, we are talking rock hard, crispy, golden on the top. Underneath, so fluffy light, but with that beef, drippingy, suety flavour and aroma. And we had it with roast dinner or stewed steak. And I just adore it. I have it so rarely now because it's something she made, only she made.
Yeah.
And it was, to me, that is ultimate indulgence. That is a savoury go-to. If ever I need that feeling of comfort, if ever I need to catapult back to the past, and if ever I just want to eat it for me, not with anybody else, that's me. The thing that I share, and the sweet thing that is my ultimate dish.
This is the sweet thing.
This is the sweet thing. This is a sea-salted caramel cake.
Oh, now everyone loves a bit of sea salt caramel, but how do we do that in a cake then?
Right. So it's a chocolate cake base, and this is the most, I'm going to say, use a really odd word for cake, supple, super moist. It's dark, but not too bitter. And it's quite a runny batter. You mix together flour, cocoa powder, sugar, and your raising agent. And then you separately mix together eggs, warm water, sea salt, and evaporated milk.
Right.
And you rub butter into the dry ingredients. And then you combine the dry and the wet together. And it is the runniest batter. You have to make sure, if it's a loose bottom tin, that you double line the bottom.
Okay, so that it doesn't leak out.
Leak through. And then I double line the sides. And it's in the oven for an hour and a half because it's so wet.
Right, so quite and that's a lower temperature
160.
Then. Right, okay. Yeah.
160. And it comes out sticky on the top, this dark brown stickiness on the top, with just enough to chop off as chef's treats.
Yeah, yeah,
because you need to level it.
Yeah, level it up, but actually the trim bit, have that with a cup of tea.
Absolutely. Now, here's the secret for this cake. This is the first time I shared this. Honestly, word of a lie. You take out the tin pretty quick. Be careful because it's delicate. Take the paper off the sides, but not the bottom. Let it go just about cold. And then when you can just feel a delicate bit of warmth, I double wrap it in food wrap and leave it for 24 hours. That tiny little bit of moisture stays in the cake, so it never dries out.
Okay, got you.
It makes it less crummy when you cut it.
Yeah.
So then when it's completely cold, I unwrap it, slice it three or four times.
Through the equator.
Oh, yeah, through the equator.
Side, not top to bottom, through the side to side.
To get three to four discs of cake.
Yeah, got you.
And then you don't need to syrup it. Some cakes you need to put a syrup on to moisten them up. This you don't.
Because you've done that little trick of wrapping it there. Yeah.
Right, here's my sea salted caramel recipe, everybody.
Okay, we're ready.
Get your pens ready. Whatever quantity you use, it's equal. So I'm going to say for a cake, 100 grams of double cream, 100 grams of light muscovado sugar, 100 grams of unsalted butter, up to 5 grams of flaky sea salt or a sea salt. There's your salted caramel recipe. No thermometer needed. Butter and sugar in the pan. Simmer it until the butter and the sugar emulsify together so there's no loose liquid butter.
Nice thick bubbles that go on.
Take it off the heat. Pour in the cream. put in the sea salt, bring it back to the boil for a few seconds, take it off, let it go completely cold. There's your salted caramel. No thermometer needed.
Wow.
It will taste like the nicest toffee butterscotch sauce you've ever had.
Wow.
Ever.
Okay.
So it's now cold and quite thick.
Yeah.
Whip up some cream, because I love cream, a little bit of sugar and vanilla in.
Yeah.
And you put a dollop of the caramel in the centre of the cake, of each disc, but not the top one. Then you pipe or spoon the cream around it, so you've got a pool of caramel in the middle, and you stack the cake on a board. And then if you want, you can cover the whole cake or you can have it as a naked cake. I don't mind. Sometimes I cover it with cream or buttercream, but naked cake's fine. Pop it in the fridge for an hour, bring it out and cut it, and you have this caramel core down the middle of the cake. And it's the moistest, chocolatiest, creamiest, most gorgeous chocolate cake.
That sounds, honestly, that
there is zero compromise. I never, ever, ever wiggle off that recipe ever, because if someone's had it and they love it and you change it.
What dish would you say that you make better than anybody else?
Oh, that's an amazing question. Oh, that's a very good question.
This isn't about being overly modest. No. This isn't showing off. But what would you say that you go, do you know what? You know, I do this thing very well. You're allowed to be, you know, confident what you do, Paul. You've got an incredible history. We know how good a pastry chef you are. You can say, I do this better than anyone else.
I think I make the best Yorkshire curd tart that has ever, ever, ever been made on the planet. Because I'm a Yorkshire lad who grew up in Durham. My grandma always kept a pint of milk from Monday to Sunday to go sour. And you strain it through a sieve to get the curds off it to make the curd tart. Sometimes called cheesecake, but it's curd tart. Yet, I am yet to buy one from a bakery that isn't dry and powdery and a bit desiccated and the ratio isn't right.
So what do I do?
Oh, I elevate it. I don't use a short crust pastry. I use a really buttery sweet pâté sucre, you know, the king of all sweet pastries. Very delicate, a bit shortbready.
Yeah.
And if I can't make the curds, I will buy a full fat cottage cheese. But best thing is to buy a Jersey cream, you know, the gold top in the supermarkets.
Yeah.
And leave it, open it, then close it. Leave it on the side in your kitchen for a week to go sour.
Yeah.
I know that's against a lot of what people want to do now by letting something turn.
Yeah.
But you need it for this. You strain it through a sieve. And what you'll have are the curds. And there don't need to be a lot of them. And these are the cheesy bits. And I mix them with some very good eggs, some unrefined sugar, nutmeg, currants, sometimes raisins, but quite often currants, and some melted butter. And it's the melted butter mixed in with that mix. I bake the tart blind, but not as full as I would for if I was filling it with a creme patissienne fruit, fully baked.
It's kind of like a really light shortbread colour.
Yeah. I put the filling in, so that is eggs, sugar, nutmeg, sometimes a little bit of mace. That's the outside of the nutmeg. That's because my grandma did.
Yeah.
Butter, sugar, currants in there, and I bake it quite low, 165, bring it out and leave it for 24 hours to go super sticky on the top.
Right, okay. Now, are you leaving it on the side or are you leaving it in the fridge?
On the side, not in the fridge. I have this thing about rock hard pastry out the fridge.
Yeah.
It's too hard. Leave it at room temperature if you can. Same with lemon tart. Don't serve it from the fridge.
Nope.
Serve it at room temperature. It's too acidic from the fridge and the pastry's too hard. And then cut it, eat it at room temperature. And for me, there's nothing else tastes like it. It's totally Yorkshire. And like I say, I've made it with full fat cottage cheese and it works just as well. That's me being lazy.
Yeah.
But it's incredible. And I think a lot of people who don't like a Yorkshire curd tart like my curd tart because it isn't dry. It's soft and silky and it has that flavour of nutmeg and mace in it.
Absolutely delicious. You talked about it there, though, and putting milk on the side and leaving it for a week to go off. And, you know, it sounds like a big, like a cooking disaster. But what's your biggest cooking disaster?
Oh, this is a post-cooking disaster, but it's part of it, and I'll never forget. So I never advertised that I made wedding cakes, but we would get asked, and I do. And they're all chocolate-based. And I would never repeat one twice. Anyway, this day, and this was about 4 years ago, and I'd had enough practice to know well better than to do what I did. I had a wedding at Canary Wharf. I made the cake in our Soho kitchen and I constructed it and thought that I could cab it there with me in the cab. I don't know why this. Usually you take it flat. You spend an hour and a half there constructing the cake so that you can get there with the cake intact.
The I'm talking quite a big cake.
I put the dowels in, which you plastic or wood through the base cake to support the next cake, then to support the next cake. The bottom cake in the cab just shook itself to pieces and flattened itself in the cab. It's one of those times where I had tears in my eyes. This was a very good wedding.
Yeah.
And I got there, took it out of the car. I had to then find the bride and groom separately because they obviously hadn't seen each other the night before.
Yeah.
To explain to them that their main cake, their bottom cake, was flat. Unacceptably flat. I carried it in. I scraped with my hands the bottom cake off the board. The top two cakes were fine. So they had this tiny mini wedding cake for a lot of people. So I rang my kitchen and said, we need to right now pack 100 boxes of chocolates to immediately be shipped over to the venue to as compensation for not having a wedding cake.
And how did it go down? Were they all right? Were they understanding?
When you're a nice person, you're authentic, and you explain exactly what's happened. The groom saw the disaster. There was a smirk on his face because what else can you do?
What can you do? Yeah.
They did have some cake, but it must have been the minuscule slither they've ever had.
What about, have you ever served anything ready-made or ready-prepared from maybe somebody else's shop and pretended it was yours?
I'm not. How dare you accuse me of that? No, I haven't, but I have been at a friend's flat where the whole dinner was served from somebody else's shop.
No, yeah. Really?
And palmed off as their own.
No.
Seriously.
I love that. Yeah. That is quite funny. What about someone else pretending they've made chocolates and they've been yours?
Oh, well, I've got a story. My best friend, Kate, she was in a bar where a chap was trying to chat her up and he told her that he was Paul A. Young.
Me. No way.
And then he said, oh, no, my friend's Paul A. Young. And she went, well, that's really funny because Paul A. Young's my best friend and I do his PR. So someone had tried to chat her up, pretended to be me. Well, I think that's great.
Yeah, that's amazing. What about a guilty pleasure? Oh. Have you got any guilty pleasure? What things do you love that you think, oh, I shouldn't be doing this?
Pork pie.
I love a pork pie.
I adore any pie.
Yeah.
Say, particularly
like a true
savory.
Yorkshireman.
Yeah. But a pork pie, the thing, so what everyone's going, oh, pork pie, that's fine. I'm not talking one of the little snacky ones. I'm talking the ones that are the full size, serves six people.
A proper one.
I can eat the whole lot.
Right. Quick fire question time.
Oh.
Weirdest chocolate you've ever tried?
A black pudding. I made it.
And what did you have for dinner last night?
Oh, my best friends, Adam and Kate, they cooked a 7-hour leg of lamb.
Yeah.
Yorkshire puddings, roast potatoes, peas, carrots, and then cheese for dessert.
That sounds delicious.
Oh, it was a day.
Did you take chocolates?
I made scones instead for afternoon tea, and I did take chocolates. I took some mezcal chocolates.
Interesting.
I'm kind of having a little explore with other things like not just tequila or something, but with mezcal.
Yeah.
Absolutely stunning.
Favourite sandwich filling?
Egg mayonnaise.
Well, yeah, that's a strong shout. Best kitchen tip you've ever been given?
Oh, I'll have to think about that. Best kitchen. Fresh is best.
Fresh is best.
Right, yeah, from
fresh
the top.
Fresh is best.
Marco
fresh is best.
Because you know when it's not.
Yeah, that's it. You can always tell. What do you listen to when you're cooking?
Radio 2. Always. Do you know what I love? I'm going to have to say, I love driving as well.
Yeah.
So if I can fit in Vernon Kay for 2 hours, then Jeremy Vine for a bit of culture. And then I absolutely adore Sarah Cox. I've loved Sarah Cox from when she did The Breakfast Show. She makes me giggle, laugh out loud. That's my day. The radio's on all day. Radio 2 just brings it on.
Best Easter egg you've ever received?
The one my mum made. When I was a kid, my mum bought an Easter egg making kit. I still have it.
No way.
I still have it. And she made, I think she probably took Bourneville.
Yeah.
And she made a little stand for it. And she made flowers on it by taking jelly fruit sweets.
Yeah.
Pâté de fruits, really.
Yeah.
And they're all a different shape. And she cut them into petals. And because they were sticky, she stuck them on the front of the egg and made the petals, the leaves. And I'll never forget that because mum's very creative.
Yeah.
And in food, in music, in crafts. And I'll never forget that egg. And I now have her moulds that she used to make it.
Magic. What's the worst thing you've ever eaten?
Oh, avocado.
Avocado?
Two things, avocados and strawberries. I can't get it past my lips.
Like, no I've way.
Yeah, it's really unusual, isn't it? I can't. I have a physical gag reaction to anything avocado. It's quite immediate.
And hold on a minute, you slipped in the word strawberry there as well. How does strawberry, in the world of pastry,
I know.
How you don't eat strawberries?
I like the flavour, like so I can eat a strawberry jam or a puree or a coulis or a reduction. I can't get a strawberry past my tongue.
And what's the ultimate comfort food?
Oh, that's a difficult one for me. I've got a lot. Any steam pudding with golden syrup,
yeah.
Stem ginger,
yeah.
Ginger puddings, ultimate comfort food.
I'm happy
to have the full 1 kilo, 1 pound size pudding for myself.
Yeah, after
the pork pie. That is ultimate comfort food for me. It makes me happier.
And then what makes you optimistic for the future?
People's never-ending love of eating out, experimenting with food and enjoying food. We are, whatever anyone says, we love with food in the UK. We always have, we always will. We are seasonal. We love our seasonal food. It's so optimistic because you know you can create something new, pop it on the menu and people get excited about it. Or you release a limited amount, people get excited about it. And people aren't afraid to taste and try something new. Without people buying food and spending more. This is the thing we have to do as an optimist thing. Spend a little bit more, not all the time if you can't afford to. But next time you buy a bar of chocolate in the supermarket, for example, not a chocolate shop, because not everyone has one near them, just spend 50p or £1 more and go up a level. That's supporting the chocolate industry that little bit more, or the chef or the restaurant, because it's never been harder in the food industry for producers, chefs, restaurateurs, pub owners to make a living with food.
Oh, Paul, well, listen, thank you ever so much for joining us on this Good Food Podcast.
Thank you.
You've been absolutely wonderful to listen to, your story, your life, early life influences, all the way through to how it's still massively affecting and pulling on the heartstrings now about that love of food. It's been amazing. Paul, thank you ever so much.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Good Food Podcast. Tune in next week when I'll be talking to Fred Sirex about his love of hospitality and experiences of world cuisine. Don't forget, our bonus cook-along episode is out on Thursday. For more recipes and inspiration, visit goodfood.com or download our app.